Okay, welcome back. Today we're talking about troubleshooting and some specific instances that you might face as a coach, whether that's looking at failing to execute race plans, lacking a kick, adhering to improper race model, anything that we might need to improve that is down and dirty in the details.
Yeah, essentially it's how does the evidence or what you see on race day, how do those lackings help you to make better decisions about where to go next in training and preparation in a season, and also too impact even like if you're working with an athlete in a scholastic setting for several years, the global progression of their capabilities year to year. But some common race day lackings, right? First one is the kick. We always talk about the kick. This person didn't have a kick. They were, you know, here through this portion of the race, whether it's 800 or 10K, and then in the final bit when everyone had to race real fast, they were out of the game, out of the ballpark. There's a lot of reasons why people don't have kicks. There's a lot. That comes to mind to me is one, it's a mechanical issue. Two, just being able to shift into a faster moving pattern. Two, it's a capacity issue. If the athlete's so globally fatigued, they can't muster the neuromuscular contraction and force that they need to run fast or faster because they're in such a state of overwhelming fatigue by the time that you know, kind of kick racing begins. And then three, it's just also a lack of speed reserve, right? They're just that you haven't sprinted. If you haven't sprinted, I mean sprinting for max velocity, 30 meters to 60 meters. If you haven't done that work ever in training or, you know, early on and continuous throughout the year, then yeah, they're not going to have a kick. So those three elements to me are what I think of first when I see someone not having a kick. What about you, Steve?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of times the kick is interesting because people have a misconception of like, oh, I just need to do a lot of like hard, fast intervals and get really tired and get used to running fast while tired. Well, I think similar to injuries, you have to look at it from both sides of the equation. Am I getting to 200 meters to go with enough juice left to do it, right? Because that's an engine capacity aerobic ability a little bit, right? Have I delved all the way into my anaerobic abilities to get to that point so I have nothing left in the tank to utilize? So that's number one. The second thing is kind of what you talked about is do I even possess the ability to change gears, right? Do I possess that skill to move off of a hard pace, whether that's in a 1500 or, you know, a 10K? They're slightly different skills, but do I know how to do that? And, you know, one of the ways I look at that is from a biomechanical standpoint, is what do my athletes try to do when they try to attempt to do that, right? Some people will just, you know, try to do more of the same, right? They've kind of got a shorter stride frequency is the key, and they'll try and get faster and faster stride frequency, but they have nowhere to go, right? Where maybe they should have learned how to change things, open up their arms, apply more force to the ground and cover more ground in that sense. Same things you see it the other way where someone has like a very powerful stride, but they don't have the ability to shift frequency a little bit and change gears in that standpoint. So I think on that side, it's giving them the skill and the ability to know what to do, right?
Right. To run fast, two things need to happen: stride frequency and length. Both need to grow. They both need to go up. A lot of times there's this, you know, misconception that it's one or the other. It's both. So how do you do that work? Well, Steve talked about, like, you need to be able to express force, express power, open up. But then you also need to be so coordinated that you can move that foot, recover that heel very quick and put it back in attack position and move it down. And this is where, if people aren't familiar with Johnny Gray and his concept of leg swing and leg speed, which are two different things but very subtle nuance, actually has a good impact. So leg speed, the way I interpret it and use it, is when that foot comes off the ground, is the athlete consciously or aware of how quickly they're moving it? Are they trying to move that foot with that heel to recover quickly in the backside of that mechanic? Boom. If that's the leg speed, the leg needs to move quickly. And we're talking about the leg in terms of the, like, for lack of a better word, the shin bone, right? The tib fib, where the calf is. So they're trying to move that leg quick. And then the swing is because the speed of the leg is moving quick when it comes through out of that recovery phase into the attack phase, then it swings down. It goes crisply down forward into the ground, not just letting gravity letting gravity coming down. You're actually applying a velocity to your leg consciously to swing the leg down crisp. And then you maintain a virtuous cycle. The leg speed is fast, the leg swing is fast. Thus, that what the result is, frequency and stride length both open up, which is an amazing thing. It's very difficult to talk, you know, in physics about the shank angle and all these angles and all these things to an athlete. The coach, we can know that's what the positions and that we're trying to move them towards, but use the simple language that the athlete can actually feel and think about as they run. I've done this many times with athletes who are running speedier reps a little too slow. Instead of say, push the ground faster, move faster, do these things faster. Yeah, coach, I'm going all out. You said sprint. This is me sprinting. You know, then I say, hey, think about leg swing and leg speed, or speed, excuse me, leg swing and speed, and own it. Own your speed. Own it. Don't just let it happen. A lot of times the brain shuts off and we just let the legs move. But if you own the sharpness that you're coordinating those limbs with, and then all of a sudden, magically, I've had athletes run 1 to 3 seconds faster on 200s, 1 to 2 seconds faster on 150s. That's significant if they're already saying that they're going at a max capacity. So that little hack, and I hate to call it a hack because it's a cue. It's a good cue that a lot of people can internalize and express quickly, can go a long way to help this concept of a kick. Now, two, you have to be practicing this over and over and over again, 1 to 3 times a week, depending on what phase you're at. 3 times a week if you're kind of in that transition phase between the foundation and competitive phase, or 1 time a week at least if you're in the competitive phase, because you're getting another time a week where you're actually doing it in real time. But if you don't practice that skill, you don't maintain it, again, you're detraining it by not having a little bit of exposure. And how much is enough? It's not a lot. It's anywhere from like 3 to 6 reps at full velocity between 30 to like 80 meters does the job really, really well. So you don't have to do a lot of this work, but you just have to do some.
And the other thing I'd say is, like, put your athletes in the position to be able to do this in practice, right? Far too often in practice, what happens is, like, we put the emphasis on running certain times. So we run those times about as easy as you can, right? But practice it, right? I'll do things where we'll do 1100s, where the first 800 we go through at, you know, 10K pace, and the last 300, we call it a wind down, right? Where you're just winding the pace down, and you're working on going through your gears, right? And if you can practice that in practice and then have a cue, like for us, it's wind it up, then, like, you can yell that, the athletes know that, the athletes have almost rehearsed that, and it becomes second nature for them to be able to utilize and do that. So it's doing that. And then the other thing that I like to do is, if athletes don't get it, like, I like to exaggerate things a little bit. Yeah. So, you know, for instance, for some of my 800 runners in the past, what we did, and we did this drill where we were doing, let's see, it was 500s, where we'd go 200. These were a bunch of 149 guys. We'd go first 200 and about 26, and then straight into an exaggerated, like, bounding type where we're really focused on force into the ground, right? And then we'd come off of that and then go into a 200 buildup off of that, right? And what happened is, like, we changed the norms, the sensation a little bit, with them having to bound in the middle of it, and added a strength component that, like, it forced them into figuring out different ways to close versus defaulting to their normal settings, right? Because we added a different level of fatigue and a different, like, sensation of doing it. So sometimes you just got to take your athletes out of you know, their default setting, their norms, and challenge them to figure out different ways to get home versus falling back on whatever it is they do.
And that's a very good point. And that's where the evidence from preparatory races throughout the season can help encourage you to make those, call those audibles in the training program, you know, whether it's the following week or the following cycle, 2-3 weeks afterwards. And you know it's worked when the athlete internalizes the teaching and can execute the teaching seamlessly. And that's where you want to continue to expose them to these variables and these lessons until that teaching becomes permanent and it's something they just do with a little bit more automation in practice, as well as, most importantly, on race day. But let's say your athlete's good on all those fronts physically, you know, and they look sharp and crisp and they know, you know, and they've been having a great season in practice, and they've been having some varying results come race day. And, you know, the lack that it's more to a degree of lack of executing a race plan and a race model in terms of you guys had a plan, you guys co-created as athlete and coach, and then the gun goes off and it went completely out the window and they just ran willy nilly. That, you know, happens as well. Remember, they're fragile human beings who get in the fight or flight mode. And sometimes that anxiety and stress and fear overrides all the logical frontal lobe cognitive process, and they just default and revert to their, you know, their worst self. But it's a self that's familiar and that they just, it's this dark, not a dark place, but it's an ineffective place that they go to. Steve, how would you handle that?
Yeah, you know, I think the first thing you got to figure out is why that occurred, right? Is it because of a lack of confidence, right, in the race plan or the race model that you guys designed? Is it a defaulting, as you said, to the to what's familiar? Is it, you know, stress and anxiety gets to them where gun goes off and all prior thoughts go out the window and out of their head? And I think number one is you got to figure out exactly that is, why did they not do the behavior that you guys discussed or came up with together? And then I think once you figure that out, then that kind of guides you towards how you handle modifying or adjusting that model in a different spot, right? So I look at it a lot of times when I say, okay, this athlete didn't execute this race model. What was the reason? Were they capable of executing this race model? And then how am I going to set them up in the future so that they learn from this and then execute it in the way that I want them to, or the way that we agree to in the future? And a lot of times what I do actually is if they didn't execute it because of, let's say, let's say that, you know, they saw it as, it was a difficult heat and they didn't think they were capable of competing really and blah, blah, blah. What I actually do is I take the pressure off, maybe next time enter them in a slower race and say, hey, like, time's out the window. You're not, like, you don't need to worry about running fast and you need to just execute this. We're judging, you shift the judgment of success from the time to, did you execute the plan that we had discussed? Because if you make that the success marker, then you have, all right, did you execute it or not? You did. Okay, success. Now we can build off of this and move forward versus, hey, you didn't execute this. Your time wasn't there either, but I don't know if your time would have been there if you actually would have, you know, done A, B, C, and D what we did. So we take that as, hey, you didn't follow this plan. Why didn't you? What's the learning plan? And how do we set you up to in the future?
There's a reason we keep, you know, track of place and time. That matters, right? And so the execution strategy is an approach to understand, yes, all racing and training is a blend of yin and yang, improv, and also planning, you know, qualitative and quantitative approach. But if you don't have a plan going into battle, 9 times out of 10, you're going to lose. And just because you have nothing, you don't have any guns to stick to, as they say, right? And if you can speak to the athlete and you can dialogue to the athlete from a space of, here is very clearly the execution strategy that we designed. Most people default to be in a certain place at a certain point or run certain splits per lap or per, you know, predecided interval. I think that's a poor model. It's a to, you know, continue to use once the athlete has demonstrated competency. Yes, for like your younger athlete or newer, a novice athlete, those are good models to build them confidence and to give them learnings and the confidence to be able to say, I can do this and I can have the integrity to do what I say. But fundamentally, it's an integrity issue, right? When you develop a more sophisticated race model, it's about having things that the athlete can say, I can grade myself with my integrity as high or very high. I aim to execute. I did execute. I got this done. And you can track it. You can know if it's a, if the race model, say in the 1500, is first 800, be in the top five of this pack. Great. That's your race model. Next 500, move from top five to an aggressive front position. Maybe not leading, but you're in an aggressive front position with a very clear line of sight with no one in your way. At whatever that takes, you know, it might not take a full effort. It might take a full effort. Then after, at 1100 meters, you can look at that person at the bell lap and say, well, were you in the front position with a clear line of sight or not? Very, very binary, black, white, yes or no. Then from there, if they execute that, let's say the last phase is with 200 to go, throw in the quickest surge you can and then see what happens. So you see how there is, again, even in a race model, you can create a race plan and a model where you're leaving things open to improv and interpretation and freedom of expression, but you're also having very concrete deliverables that you can look to the athlete and you can have a debrief over. Too often, the debrief is just, I wasn't feeling good, coach. I didn't feel good, so I got scared, or I didn't want to do it, and or I don't know, they were really fast, and I looked at the clock, and I said, I decided I can't run the last lap with them because they run, you know, this, and I run that. I go, whoa, we're just taking all the opportunity to grow, learn, experiment, and also transcend limits out of that race if we elect that kind of I ain't feeling it narrative.
And I think it's very important to have the ability as a coach to have athletes who are help them have the maturity to like be able to be self-aware to analyze that stuff. Mm-hmm. Right. They need to, you know, for instance, I'm actually kind of happy when my athletes tell me, hey, coach, like, you know, in this 800 from 500 to 600, I checked out.
Yeah.
Right. I checked out and like, I don't know why, but I kind of checked out and then didn't get re-engaged until the final 150 or something like that. And that gives me something to work on and to say, okay, like this athlete is saying, hey, for some reason mentally they checked out of that. And now I have to work on giving them the right tools, cues. They have to do the right self-assessment, self-work to make sure that that focus of attention isn't lost. Versus saying like, hey, you know, I wasn't feeling good. You know, legs felt like shit. So I didn't have it.
And that's one of the key things about sport. Sport is a crucible to learn and teach accountability. And if an athlete's not 100% accountable to their actions on race day, that's a bigger issue that you need to address. Because if someone can't execute a race model that they co-created with their coach, it'd be different if the coach just said, you're doing this and that's it, right? If it's top down. But if it's collaborative, then all of a sudden, now we have a lack of integrity and we have a lack of accountability. The athlete needs to own what they did, their actions, 100%. That's a very important thing that's going to be useful not only in sport but also in life forever. And that's, we have to remind ourselves as coaches that we are still teaching and coaching that very important value, whether you're coaching middle school, high school athletes, or like myself, adults, and understanding like every opportunity is a learning experience and saying, hey, you figured out a way not to do that well. Here's a way not to do it well. Checking out from 506. It didn't do it well. Own that because you're the one who checked out. I didn't stop encouraging you. I didn't stop watching the race. I didn't check out. I didn't, as a coach, I didn't, you know, not show up to this week with a training plan for you. I didn't show up to the race without a race plan for you. You're saying I'm delivering as the coach every step of the way. And as long as your interior coach is true, the athlete's going to be like, huh, I guess you're right. I need to deliver too. And so it creates this, you know, symbiotic relationship of mutual deliverabilities. And if you do that and you continue to preach that, like I'm going to be stride for stride with you on this in terms of I'm going to deliver all my deliverables. And guess what? You can do it too. You're capable of it. you know, and then you're setting yourself and the athlete up for a long-term success, not just, you know, on the track running around these circles here and now, but running around the circles of life for decades to come.
Exactly, 100%. And I think, you know, the last part on this section is, I think it's important, like, that accountability thing is important. And I think the other thing that you have to work on is making sure athletes aren't looking for, like, the magic solution coming off either a poor race or a poorly executed race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the answer as an athlete, they're in that emotional state, and if they're a little immature, what happens is they default to trying to find some solution that you know, takes away responsibility a little bit. And they'll sit there and be like, oh, well, you know, I need to do more of this, mm-hmm. right? I need to be in the weight room more. Or I need to do, you know, mile repeats instead of K repeats, right?
Yeah.
As if there's some tangible answer. And your job as a coach is always to refocus and recenter from that, from look for the almost the excuse to, like, defer thinking, to make the athlete do the hard work to understand, okay, what am I learning and am I taking away from this, yeah. right? And they're two completely different mindsets.
Yeah, and one of my favorite verses in the Bhagavad Gita is, you have the right to the work only, but never to its fruits. And there's sometimes an entitlement that I worked hard that I should then get this outcome. And no, you have to go execute and own it, and you have to make it happen. And that's where, as a coach, you can hear their reasonings or their explorational thoughts on maybe work that they need to do to make the race model or race plan happen. But also, too, you have to draw a sharp line and sometimes call them out and say, look, you just got to get it done. Yeah. Period. You just have to get it done. There's not a whole dialogue. It's not like, oh, I have to be in the right emotional moment and I need to, you know, have the, you know, the maximum, you know, best conditions possible. If it's windy, I can't do it. If it's raining, I'm going to melt. Like, you just got to show up and get it done. That's what delivering is called. And I remind people like this, the mailman, the mailwoman, they show up every day. They deliver every day. Doesn't matter the weather. The mail comes through. And as athletes, a good athlete does that, no matter the external vicissitudes that are faced to them. And that's, too, as coaches, where we're shaping. Because it's easy to place a lacking outside of us. I don't have this capacity yet. I don't have this yet. Okay, let me get in the weight room and do this. And then I always ask, well, how many reps in the weight room do you need to do to get stronger until you're stronger, and then that can be executed? And then the athletes look at me like, they'll name me the reps. Like, if it's 1,000 reps, okay, we'll do 1,000 reps. And after 1,000 reps, then you'll be ready to go. And so this is where you have to be very empathetic as a coach, but sometimes also draw a sharp line and come across as an empathetic hard ass, as I say. Because if you're not giving them truth, if yeah. you're not holding them to a high account, if you're not checking their standards of excellence and checking their integrity, you're fundamentally doing yourself and the athlete both a disservice. But again, the empathy, that's why I preface it, is key. You know, you hear a lot of tough love. It's actually love tough. Love, unconditional love for your athlete as a human being in life, as a person, but be tough on them. Those are the people who will grow the most and thank you the most. Too often we go tough love, and the tough part creates this sour and bitter taste in people's mouth, and they forget the love message. So for me personally, when I see a race day lacking, especially when it comes to lack of integrity in a plan, and it's a consistent thing that's been happening for races and seasons and years, at a certain point, yeah, it's just about a lot of kicking in the butt. But I always preface it with this: I think you're the most amazing, wonderful person. I have all the respect for your world. This is coming from a space of wanting to see you thrive, not that you suck at life. And here I am to help you. So, you know, the last one we'll end on is, typically what happens is in the last quarter of a race, you know, the athlete, quote unquote, running out of steam, right? And 9 times out of 10, what happens the last quarter is predicated by what happened in the first 3/4. And more often than not, what happened in the first quarter of the race? Did the athlete go out too fast, too hot? Or maybe they went right out at what you guys planned and your strategy was, right? At the right rhythm or right pack or right intensity, and they still faded. So there's some psychological things to consider and also physiological elements in training to address when that expresses itself to be, you know, again, habitual. And I look at things, I always look for the, you know, an evidence set of at least three. That's my minimum. If you have three races or three things that are kind of within a close time frame, that's a very clear signal of a pattern. A one-off is of you know, random, a variable, you know, just it happens. Two kind of makes you go, huh. And then three is like, yep, for sure this is an issue and we need to address it. So Steve, when that happens, and I know you've seen it happen a lot and it's manifests even more exponentially in the longer distance events like the marathon and half marathon, you know, how do you address?
Yeah, you know, what I look at is I see it as a almost an insecurity and not having the confidence to execute things the way that you need to when you fade at the end, right? And I look at, you know, I always think back to the what I've heard Mark Wetmore scream at his athletes all the time in cross country, which is check your instruments, right? And what Wetmore is doing, and I've never asked him about this, but what I assume he's doing there is empowering the athletes to, you know and be able to read their bodies for how much they have left, right? And to divvy that effort out. And that's how I see, especially racing at the longer distances, is divvying that effort out so that you're exhausted right when you hit the finish line, right? Yep. You cross it, ideal race, like you cross it and you're just like falling to the ground right after it. That means you executed your energy distribution, you know, optimally, essentially.
It's impulse control.
Yeah. So, you know, that's how I see these issues if they start to fade late, is most of the time it's that impulse control issue. Like they didn't have the confidence or the awareness to be able to read their body and say, how much gas do I have left in the tank? And I think the way I address that is by simply, first sharing that with them, but then addressing it in practice, right? Is putting them in situations where they have to judge. So that means taking the control away from me and saying, hey, you have 5x mile and you're going to run them all at 450 and jog 2 minutes rest in between. And then instead, what I'll do is I'll say, you know, you have 5x mile.
Yeah.
What do you want? What do you want, coach? Best effort.
Yeah.
Right? And what does that mean? Well, then they have to judge and figure out, okay, what is the sustainable effort that I can do for five of these, right? And then they're paying attention to that first one to kind of sit there. They finish the first one and like, oh, well, that was meant, you know, I handled that pretty well. Like I might be able to go a little faster. Or, ooh,
yeah.
You know, that like, I don't know if I'm going to get through five, you know? And it's learning those skills of reading your body or checking your instruments that allow you to have that ability to divvy up your effort.
Yeah. And I think first it is that to me, the first check when that happens is the psychological check of impulse control. Again, we know from the marshmallow test, right? How you control that impulse is a determinant for how well you will do later on in life. But two, most people, when the gun goes off, that's actually an explosion of ego and adrenaline. All the impulse control goes out and they start running someone else's race. And this comes back to the run your own race. When you hear athletes talk about, I ran my own race. I just ran my own race. I didn't worry about what everyone else was doing because I checked myself and I went in with a very detailed and concrete race plan and strategy and model for me that was going to maximize my ability on the day. And those people who run their race, whether they're, you know, in a 100 meter sprint final at the Olympic championships or whether they're, you know, in the JV heat of this mid-April invite, they are practicing a very important skill that's going to yield dividends, you know, to come for many, many years down the road, because this ability to focus internally as well as be aware externally is key. And when you're not running your own race, when you default and because of fear, ego, and adrenaline, just keep up with someone else because you're supposed to be, that's supposed to be their, your competition. That's supposed to be the person you need to beat. Well, remember, you're supposed to beat them, or you're trying to beat them at the end, not in the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. And this is what, you know, Wetmore is, sounds like he's advising. And when you control, when you depend on like the competition to bring out your best work, you surrender all the control over and your most important asset, which is your own ability to execute what you had in a very confident and not as alarmed state, decided beforehand would be your best strategy and your best tactic. So that is 9 times out of 10 to me, if the athlete's well-trained, and this goes back to executing the race model. You see how it all kind of bleeds together, right? These different nuances on different specifics, but they bleed together. And when you have a holistic training paradigm that addresses not only the psychological, the physiological, you know, and all the other bits that influence the whole ecosystem of the athlete, you can really start to make strides, and they can really start to make strides. But let's say, you know, again, that psychological element is controlled and they are fading in the last quarter. What it shows you is you have to go back to the drawing board and just get the capacity to endure at those competitive speeds they want to play at a little bit longer. And, you know, I always like, you know, the Jerry Schumacher train of thought here, which is he goes overboard in aerobic, you know, metabolism work because he's trying to get the athletes to the real racing as fresh as possible. And so if your ability to, you know, aerobically process and, you know, move oxygenated blood to working tissues is so advanced that the speed of play you're now like playing your game at, whether it's high school, you know, or college or world-class athletes, is so comprehensive, or your ability is so comprehensive relative to it, then when you get to the real racing in the last quarter, you feel fresh as a daisy, or pretty fresh comparative to the rest of the competition. So is the answer just more aerobic work? No. The answer is a little bit more capacity work on all fronts, because we know holistic training is not reductionist, that I just focus on this one element. So it's increasing the capacity of someone's lactate threshold work, adding an extra 3 minutes or adding an extra 5 minutes to that in a session, increasing maybe the capacity of their kind of aerobic work, adding an extra mile or 2 miles, if that makes sense, to a long run, increasing the capacity of their true sprint work, adding one extra rep of 5 seconds at max velocity, as long as there's no, you know, huge deceleration or breakdown, finding little ways to increase over time. Remember, it also, like my favorite quote also comes from Jerry. I remember last year, actually, Evan Jaeger ran like a pretty piss poor 1500 for Evan Jaeger at the Stanford Invite. And Jerry's like, well, that's another 6 weeks of training you gotta like now, you know, do. So he just, even for Jerry, right, he knows the timeline for a world-class athlete like Evan Jaeger to bounce back or assimilate and adapt to training loads is about 6 weeks. So those early races are key for a reason. They give you that check-in, they give you that pulse so that you know how to go back into training and elements that you need to focus on and increase so the athlete can execute and can deliver, can have a kick, can be in the conversation in the last or latter phase of a race.